Good morning, folks. It's time for Democratic Perspective, brought to you by the Verde Valley Independent Democrats, a weekly talk show about political issues facing the Verde Valley, Sedona, Northern Arizona, and the nation at large. Join us for a stimulating, thought-provoking discussion. You'll get the facts as we focus on the real challenges facing Arizonans. Good morning, folks. Steve Williamson here. Sitting across from me is Mike somebody.
Hola, Cosentino. Mike, everybody's Cosentino. You know, I've heard that joke three times this week.
Oh, really? Well, now you've heard it four times.
Yes, right.
Gary and, somebody.
Gary somebody.
Gary LeMaster.
Silent
good,
Gary.
Good morning, everyone.
Gary LeMaster. A couple of weeks ago, we did a show on terrorism.
We're going to hate America
American
this morning.
Response.
We're going to hate all over America this morning. We're going to get some letters this morning.
No. We did a show on terrorism and the responses to terrorism, and we tried hard to define terrorism or show you that there's a lot of different aspects of, or different variations on the definition of terrorism. Generally, terrorism is an attack on civilians to achieve some political or religious purpose. So when Al-Qaeda attacks the coal, destroyer, that's not a terrorist attack. That's a surprise attack like Pearl Harbor. It's a military attack on a military target. When they blow up a bunch of civilians, that's terrorism, especially if they really want to inspire terrorism.
When Obama's drones kill women and children, that's not terrorism.
So today,
that's a response.
Yes. So what today we want to talk about, and one of our producers said, what you didn't really go into when you talked about terrorism is what's called blowback. Blowback is a CIA term. It originally applied to CIA operations. When CIA does an operation like overthrowing the democratically elected government of Iran in 1953, Gary?
Yes.
Yeah. When they do that, there's a blowback in that the Iranians find out about it and they don't like us. And so decades later, the United States Embassy gets seized. And so what Americans are weakest at, I think, in international affairs is seeing the reason for it. So when, you know, I think Bush, what did he originally claim? That Al-Qaeda was doing this because they hate our freedoms. That's, you know, that's just pure subjective propaganda. So what we want to look at today is some of the reasons that we get blowback. What in American foreign policies over decades and decades, what in American secret operation causes blowback against the United States?
Do you think there's legitimate reasons for other countries to have blowback, to hate the United States, to try to get even with you? You think there's things we've done, errors we've made in foreign policy?
It's not so much a matter of legitimacy in my mind, Mike, and maybe in yours, but in my mind, it's a matter of understanding how other people think and react. So, is it fair for the Iranians to seize our embassies decades and decades after we overthrow their government? That's a question, but the only thing I'm saying is, legitimate or not, they had a reason, they had a perceived legitimate reason in their mind.
We want them to be more American and not have a memory and forget stuff, like Gore Vidal said, the USA stands for the United States of Amnesia. Politicians commit all sorts of atrocities, and we don't remember it past the next news broadcast.
So when I was young, it was all kinds of anti-Americanism in Latin America, but it was never explained to why people in Latin America were so pissed off at the United States. There was no explanation for it. Vice President Nixon, if I remember when I was a little kid, went down, and I remember hearing, oh, they threw rocks at him and stuff, and why are they doing that, and people hate us. But what we don't look at is what we do that helps to cause this.
A lot of it is, frankly, our corporations going around the world, trying to take other people's resources and pay them virtually nothing for it, and then our military being asked to step in and support our corporations, which is really what it comes
Let's
down to.
Let's go to Guatemala.
So you're calling the U.S. fascist?
No. To a degree, yes.
Go ahead.
Let's go to Guatemala. And Guatemala is an example of United States, powerful economic interest in United Fruit Company and other companies. And those companies, when there becomes a slightly left-wing Guatemalan government, populist government. Those companies call on the United States to intervene, and they do. They secretly overthrow the populist leader of Guatemala at the, really at the behest of the corporation. So what Gary is saying, as I think you're saying, is that a lot of it is this right-hand, left-hand thing of American companies' special interests abroad in, say, oil industry.
We're involved in South America for minerals and in Southeast Asia initially for rubber. And other,
we've tested WMDs in various countries without letting the local population know, including our own.
The Caribbean and Central America, we were after sugar and bananas, and in the Middle East, we were after oil.
Right. Yeah. I mean, why do we overthrow a populist government in Iran? I mean, why do we care whether they have a populist government or not?
They were going to nationalize the oil.
They nationalized the oil. It's a complicated story. The British, who actually have the interest, go to the Americans and help and get us to help overthrow the populace who are going to nationalize the oil. So a lot of this is, as Gary says, the interweaving of economic interests and political operations. So blowback is the reaction that we get worldwide, and it's continuing all the time to both corporate stuff and American decisions. Sometimes they're based on raw materials or economic interests, and sometimes they're based on establishing power. So if you look at the invasion of Iraq, is it the question, Gary, and give me your point of view, is it about establishing and reorganizing the Middle East, or is it just about oil?
A lot of it came about during the Cold War, especially. It was when it really blew up. But when we were supporting dictators that were the enemies of our enemies, so therefore were our friends. But a lot of it was simply in the so-called interest of stability. We would support some brutal dictator because, you know, he kept that, you know, population and, you know, controlled and kept it stable for American interests, i.e. corporations.
I was talking to an African diplomat one time right after the breakup of the Soviet Union, and he said really emphatically, because this was not a high-level diplomatic conversation. It was in a bar across from the UN, and I was the bartender. He said, there is not one issue. There's not one policy in my country that either the Russians or the Americans don't try to tell us what to do. We're constantly torn between these two countries back and forth. And I said to him, well, I don't know. See, now that the Soviet Union has collapsed, see if it's better if you have one country telling you what to do. But it was a heartfelt statement. It was not some political rhetoric. It was deeply felt by this diplomat of the way his country was being treated, jerked one way and then jerked another.
If we're looking for a simple answer, which we always do, I mean, because regardless of the name of the show, as democratic perspective, we are Americans, and we want things simple. We don't want to complicate things. We want to be able to watch the Super Bowl and in peace. And I think the sarcasm here is that whenever we forget who we're supposed to be,
Or who we think we are, exactly.
Whenever we abdicate our moral responsibility, according to the title of a recent article I read, whenever we forget that we're supposed to be champions for human rights worldwide, that's how we used to be looked at until we became the worldwide advocates of torture. When we forget that, and time and time and time again, whether it's chemical weapons, whether it's invading a country, whether it's setting up a government, whether it's whatever CIA atrocity is happening most recently, that's when the blowback happens. That's when it comes, and it should come.
Let's give an example, and we can go all the way back to Vietnam. In Vietnam, we supported the French colonialists in keeping control of Vietnam against a very militant nationalist and communist government.
And for its resources.
And for its resources. And we set up and supported a government of minority Catholics in South Vietnam. The Catholics in South Vietnam were seen by 90% of the Vietnamese population as collaborators with the French. That was why they were Catholic. And so we set up this regime in South Vietnam, and then we had to support it. And we sent in more and more troops because it never had support that it couldn't buy. It never had support it couldn't buy beyond its Catholic base. And it's not Catholics are good or bad. It's just that's how the power politics work. So when we support this, then we set off a reaction, and more than 50,000 Americans end up getting killed, maybe a million Vietnamese. That's what happens when you don't understand what you're doing. We didn't really know anything about Vietnam. We didn't know anything about the Vietnamese people.
Is that what you're offering for an excuse? Is that we're just ignorant? That's okay, though, because
it's not an excuse. It's a terrible mistake. Ignorance to send troops into a country without knowing anything about Vietnamese history or the way Vietnamese thought about stuff, that their whole definition of themselves is resisting foreign invasion, to not realize that they hate the Chinese. I'm sorry, that's not fair, but they hate the Chinese because the Chinese dominated their country. And to go in there claiming that they're agents of the Chinese government is just so preposterously ignorant that a lot of people get killed.
And it was blown out of proportion with the lie of the Gulf of Tonkin. You know.
Once you're going to do something like that, then you get into what was the famous phrase? You get into a web of lies to make it work. Gary's saying, you have to have an attack on the United States to make it work. And that goes all the way back to Spanish-American War, right?
The Maine, which was, it turns out, was probably blown up by its own boiler. But we viewed it as an attack by the Spanish, which gave us permission to go in and take Cuba and the Philippines.
Right. And so we go in and we say we're supporting the Cuban rebels, the locals, against the Spanish government, but what do we actually end up doing, Gary?
We end up in the Philippines, we end up waterboarding, by the way.
We end up killing thousands of Filipinos in order to establish, we get rid of the Spanish, okay, that's
right.
Great, but then we turn, and then we have a problem with the rebellion of the Filipinos who do not want us replacing the Spanish, and that turns into another war.
Teddy Roosevelt wrongly viewed the Philippines as the gateway to the Orient, or to Asia, and so we went in with full force to take control of it because we thought that would give us access to the resources throughout Asia.
Yeah, it was the gateway to China, didn't they call it the gateway to China?
Howard Zinn does a beautiful job explaining the expansion of the American Empire and deals specifically, because he was there, with the invasion of the he wasn't there. With the invasion of the Philippines, he deals beautifully with it in the people's history of the United States, and he has this wonderful graphic history book called American Empire, that's a wonderful job of tracking the invasion of the Philippines.
As I mentioned, that's where we perfected waterboarding. Yeah. We called it the cure in order to get information from Filipinos.
Practice.
I was going to Howard Zinn is kind of a hero and willing to be able to take on the stuff. Another hero, the guy who really popularizes the term blowback is Chalmers Johnson. Chalmers Johnson was a cold warrior. He was an expert on China. He worked with the CIA at a very high level for 6 or 7 years. At least that's public. And he supported, he began to have doubts, I think, really with the collapse of the Soviet Union. Because when Chalmers Johnson looked at it, he said, well, we've used all these, we're fighting communism around the world, and suddenly there's no communism. There was no reduction in American military power. There was no pullback of the bases. He went to Okinawa, and the Okinawans are furious at having a large part of their island occupied by, I don't know, a dozen different U.S. bases. And that's where he started thinking about it. And he wrote a whole series of books. Mike's read, which one did you read? Blowback. That's where we get the title.
I read the review.
And he wrote The Sorrows of Empire. And the other one, that I think is the last one. Now, he's very pessimistic, and he's very, when I was talking about earlier, Gary and Mike, about the idealism, Chalmers, Johnson is operating from where he thinks the United States should be and looking at where it's actually becoming. He's looking at how a democracy is turning more into a militarized society. And that turns him from a cold water, a warrior and a supporter of the establishment to somebody who is a major questioner of it.
Well, so what do we do about it? I'm looking at an article that was written shortly after 9/11, and they talk about taking the high road. They're throwing out phrases of old tired phrases in 2001, and here it is 2015. Things like national security as an excuse for everything. We can think of human security. I mean, we can replace national security with human security. Close the bases. The bases in Saudi Arabia, places like Saudi Arabia, cause us more enemies, as far as blowback goes, than it protects American lives. I mean, I think if you have a base somewhere and it's protecting American lives, well, there's an argument to be made there.
But what Chalmers, Johnson, documented was hundreds, if not a thousand, or so bases scattered all around the world. Some of them big, some of them small. They're everywhere, all over the world, and they generate the kind of thing you're talking about, Mike. It's a really negative reaction. It doesn't have to be Okinawa, where we've taken so much of the decent land there, and we end up with a permanent.
No, the Air Force is full of places with 12 people sitting on a mountaintop with enough electronics around them. Yeah, even back in my day, we had those places.
Yes,
and so the sanctions against Iraq. We've had sanctions against Iraq and Iran. Excuse me, Iran. On and off for a long time.
Since the 50s.
Right? Yeah.
And probably before.
And it's not that they don't hurt. It's not that they hurt civilian populations. Whatever the effectiveness is, it creates blowback of an incredibly large degree.
It's economic terrorism. And
it is,
you know, the people that suffer from the sanctions aren't the leaders that we have issues with. The people that suffer from the sanctions are the ordinary people that are just trying to eke out a living.
Exactly. We do want to deal aggressively with, and we are. The one thing we are doing right, you know, is dealing aggressively with individual terrorists. Go after, you know, use all of our powers of identification, of tracking, of satellites, and go after the perpetrators.
I think people, we all agree about
people
that.
People understand, yes, exactly, even the other side, that is not maybe prone to agreeing with America, that is prone to blame, but it says, well, you know, we're down with revenge. We get revenge.
Right. I mean, I think if you're an anti-American terrorist or an anti-French terrorist, you're not surprised when the police come and shoot it out with you because you're an enemy, and you know you're an enemy.
And often they look forward to that.
And when Al-Qaeda attacks a U.S. destroyer, it's because they're at war with us.
But
There's no softening that. They're at war with us. It's a surprise attack. They kill a bunch of American. That's what they want to do.
But even at that, I would prefer we do it through the organizations that we've set up. The worldwide organizations, these unilateral actions cause blowback.
A lot of it is, you know, what happens is George Bush and really the people around him abandoned at least the facade of working through international organizations and through alliances. And what they say is we're gonna act whenever we want to act. This is what they tell the world, wherever we want to act.
That's right.
And we're not going to ask anybody's
That's
permission.
Right.
We're not going to necessarily explain what we do except to some propaganda banners. And we're not going to even consult our allies. And we're not even going to ask. We're going to do everything ourselves.
The
and you end up with Iraq.
The conservatives love this time in history. They see us as with the fall of... That wasn't the anniversary of the fall of the Berlin Wall. With the fall of the Soviet this week, the Soviet Union, we're the one guy left standing. And so they love this time in history. And to do anything else than to be the biggest bully on the block is somehow anti-conservative. Instead of being the biggest human rights sponsor on the block, instead of being the biggest democratic model on the block, instead of being, well, oh yeah, the best health care, instead of taking care of it. No, what do we got? We want to be the biggest bully on. We want to be the toughest guy on the block. We don't want to get us out of the stinking UN. Forget about the international court. Let's.
And there's a whole rhetoric of this, and I wish I had taken down the notes that some of the guys used to explain this. But let's look at two patterns of blowback. One of them is Al-Qaeda itself. Al-Qaeda is created basically when the United States secretly arms, trains the Afghanistani, and the opposition to the Afghanistani government supported by the Soviets is entirely very extreme right-wing religious people. We enable Al-Qaeda. We make Osama bin Laden a huge hero in Afghanistan. We help train and fund these people, and then it blows back on us.
The other aspects of that was that played along with the creation of Al-Qaeda was and what bin Laden was most angry about was our base that we created in Saudi Arabia in order to take back Kuwait from Saddam Hussein. That was one of the flashpoints for Al-Qaeda.
I think we have to not agree with, but put ourselves, not so much in Osama bin Laden, but in other peoples to understand why. I mean, you go into Afghanistan. Afghanistan is a country that has resisted foreigners back since Alexander invaded it in, 300 BC. It has a history of taking on foreigners and defeating them, whether you're British, Russian, or American. We've created a pseudo-government. We installed this guy, Karzai, who was living in the West as a president. He had no support. We propped him up for years. He spit on us. He called us names. He accused us of all kinds of stuff. And he never rose from the processes, the political processes of Afghanistan. And so we have that. But it's not just the United States. We can go back to this, but it's not just the United States that does this. And I'm looking at the Israeli invasion of Lebanon. Now, when the Israelis invaded Lebanon, what was it, in 80, 79, something like that? When they invaded Lebanon, originally the Lebanon is divided into all kinds of different religious groups, Druze, Shiite, Sunni. It's got different tribes. It's got different variation. When the Israelis invaded Lebanon, the real opposition were sort of rationalist a Shiite militia. After almost a decade of occupation, may have been a little longer, we end up with Hezbollah. Right, Hezbollah, in my view, is a blowback to Israeli policy. They invaded Lebanon, they occupied Lebanon, they turned people who were sympathetic to them into people who really, really hated them badly and wanted them out of their country. So the blowback, when you see the fight now between Hezbollah and Israel, its blowback, Hezbollah did not really exist. There were some pre-Hezbollah groups, did not really exist until the Israeli invasion gets settled into Lebanon.
The blowback that has exploded the most in the last year, for us anyway, has been the Islamic State. That kind of drama. And just, we're talking about mass executions and confinements of civilians. We're talking about sexual enslavement, and I'm going to mispronounce this, but Yazidi women. And girls,
I think that's right.
Videotape beheadings of journalists. These people got, these are not nice folks. But they didn't get created in a vacuum.
Okay, when does it start?
Maliki. Well, when we installed,
Paul Bremer, when he debathicized Iraq following our invasion,
here's the contradiction.
And kicked all of these people out of their jobs.
And I agree,
from military to school teachers.
But it's the invasion itself, I think, Gary. In other words, we have this awful dictator in Saddam Hussein in Iraq,
who we supported for many years.
We
by the
support
way.
Against the Iranians, a part of politics. All right. But it was a limited support. We have this awful dictator, and when we go in to replace the awful dictator, The whole country divides into its various ethnic and tribal groupings and to its religious grouping.
Which they were told would happen.
Right. And they were warned that this stuff would happen, and they didn't care. They went in and did it anyway. They had this was when the United States policy was controlled by neoconservatives.
It was part of Cheney's plan for a new American century.
Right.
It was a central piece of it.
Right.
Permanent bases in the Middle East and blah, blah.
So the creation of Islamic State goes back. It's a long series of events. It goes back to our invasion of Iraq and taking over. It goes back to the de-Ba'athization. I got that right. When we threw out all the people who had been Ba'ath officers and took away their living, and they went into opposition.
And they were mostly Sunni, by the way.
Right. So.
Well, that said, how does minority Sunnis get radicalized from Maliki? Well, because the Shiites
that were massacred them.
Well, the entire corruption, the brutality.
Right, so we set up, we replace a corrupt dictator with a corrupt pseudo democracy.
Who marginalized the Sunnis and the Kurds.
All right. So how do we get Islamic State? And they'll say, well, Obama didn't intervene enough. Obama didn't keep enough troops there. We get the Islamic state a lot because of the surge. The surge seemed so successful. I never believed it. And frankly, I've been predicting this for years. I was a little bit wrong on the timing, or a lot wrong on the timing. But what the surge did was to take out the Al-Qaeda and Sunni tribal units that were large and visible, right? They couldn't mass and stuff. And the surge was extremely successful in killing large numbers of those people, large numbers of their leadership. They replaced the old sort of staid Al-Qaeda leadership that was getting long in the tooth with new guys. And what they did was suppress the opposition, suppress Al-Qaeda, suppress the Sunni nationalists, and they went underground. And what ISIS, ISIL, IS is a resurgent of the people who went underground, reorganized themselves. They now call themselves, go ahead, Gary.
And a lot of these people are ex-military, the Ba'athist military that functioned under Saddam. A lot of them are people that resurfaced because they were frustrated with the marginalization by the Shia-led government.
So in a way, the surge helps create IS. And originally, ISIS, which now wants to control the whole of Levant, was based in Iraq. And their innovation, because the leadership of Al-Qaeda had been pretty much killed off, the innovation of the new guys was to start taking territory, and that the civil war in Syria was opening up the possibility to gain territory. And they broke with Al-Qaeda, got into a big argument with them, got denounced by Al-Qaeda, they're too brutal, and so forth and so on. But they went on with a very different strategy to establish a state.
And recruited a lot of U.S. trained soldiers and embraced a lot of U.S. paid for military equipment.
So we spent all these years and billions of dollars, right, Mike, building up the Iraqi army, and we find out that most of the army are ghost troops who are not even troops. They're just officers collecting cash from the United States via the Iraqi government.
Well, the Sunnis that are being bombed by the Iraqi Air Force would not call them a ghost army. They'd say it's pretty real. There are real atrocities being perpetrated still on Sunni populations.
There's apparently been a massacre by the Shiite militiamen that are accompanying the Iraqi army of a bunch of Sunni tribesmen who were opponents of IS. We think the Shiites massacre them because they think they're collaborators. They actually call people's names out. How many times have we heard this in history? They go into a village, they call that guy's name, they take the men all out and shoot them in the head.
Right.
Right. I mean, this is, and so now what's going to be the effect of that on the Sunni tribes that, see, the thing about ISIS is that it's extremely brutal and sort of incompetent in the way it does some things and competent in the ways it does others. It's making its own enemies. It's making enemies of every Shiite that comes in contact with them. It's making enemies of every Kurd, every Yazidi, everybody who doesn't agree with them. It's creating its own opposition, aside from anything we're doing.
Two of the things that I think are in common with Iraq and Afghanistan and most of the trouble areas and the blowback are one, corruption. You know, in Afghanistan and Iraq, we've seen incredibly corrupt government where they took billions of dollars of U.S. monies, and instead of using it to help the population, they used it to line their pockets and the pockets of their relatives and friends. The other thing is a massive propaganda campaign, you know, worldwide, but led by U.S. media, news media, that, you know, disguises what's going on and you know, it kind of evolves into this flag-waving patriotism that you're either, you know, with us or you're against us, but it never delves into the issues that cause the problems to begin with.
How about Syria? Another awful dictator. He represents a minority religion. And he has the support really of all the other minority religions in Syria. That's why he's still in power all these years later. There's a public opposition to him, civil opposition to him. It quickly disintegrates into armed opposition. And the people who come out on top of the armed opposition are Al-Qaeda types and the IS. In other words, once people start shooting, the lawyers and the doctors and the philosophers get replaced by the gunmen. And we've gone in, waded into yet another civil war. The excuse is always a good one in a way. I mean, he's a bad guy. He's doing terrible things in the country, and so forth and so on. And I don't know if you want to comment, Gary, but give the president the credit for not getting as involved. I believe, and I don't see what Mike thinks, I think the neoconservatives, the liberal interventionalists, still control American policy.
Well,
they have incredible power in it, right?
Yesterday's article in Foreign Policy magazine from Barack Obama says, don't overplay the importance of ISIS, of the Islamic State. I'm going to talk about that in a second. But first, getting back to your point that in Syria, the Islamic State portrays itself as the only power that can defeat Assad. And once again, there's always this confusion of support when Al-Qaeda in Iraq morphs into the Islamic State as being the only force powerful enough to defeat the corruption Gary was talking about of Maliki and even the new guy, although the new guy has taken some steps because he could see that Maliki's corruption had caused this incredible amount of blowback.
The reactionaries in our government, primarily Senator McCain and Senator Graham, wanted to immediately when Assad was being challenged, wanted to immediately go in with American support,
right,
and give funds and arms to the groups opposing Assad. Unfortunately, there were about a dozen or more,
right,
groups opposing him, and they were fragmented, and it was hard to sort out who were the good guys and who were the bad guys.
And they stole most of the money we gave them.
And so, you know, in essence, if we had followed their advice at that point, we would have been helping to arm and finance the Islamic State.
Some of the American prisoners, I believe there's two of them, have talked about being captured by people other than the Islamic State and either being handed over to the Islamic State for no particular reason or for money.
Well, because they were seen as...
Or handed over to Al-Qaeda by supposedly pro-American militiamen.
Well, it's
a tricky business, right, Mike? Go ahead.
Yeah, no, without a doubt. As Al-Qaeda morphs into Islamic... So to what Gary was saying, that we would have been supporting what has morphed into Islamic State if we had followed the advice of these reactionary Republicans.
In those chaotic...
Who are still criticizing Obama, by the way, at least, for not doing that.
in those chaotic situations, it's almost almost impossible to vet the various groups. We don't have people on the ground to really understand what's going on.
Well, Obama's famous dalliances in this case was waiting to see who emerged, who you could support. You know, who was willing to take the, the pound their chest and flick out their arm and say, "Heil America!" And
he was right to wait.
He was right to wait to see who emerged. Now, what happened is that the Islamic State became powerful because of incredible funding, because of weapons, Soviet weapons, American weapons. They have a lot of money and a lot of weapons.
So
they've been more effective than anybody
weapons.
Thought they could be because of the support that they have.
And because they are fanatics, and they're using old-fashioned terror. This is, it goes way back into history. I mean, the Romans would go into a province, they would kill the fighters, and they would go kill most of the population. Attila the Hun. The standard use of, what was it, Valdi Impaler, who protected
Vlad, yeah.
Vlad the Impaler, who put everybody's head on a stake. So terrorism against enemies, in other words, terrorizing your enemies by killing the prisoners.
Well, winning
and
the
stuff.
Support of local populations is key to the militant group's long-term success. And I'm getting a lot of this stuff from Foreign Policy magazine, by the way, and website,
which is a magazine of mostly of the American conservative political establishment, the thinkers who are behind a lot of bad policies as well as good ones.
To Mike's point, one of the issues, the Taliban, what Taliban actually means or stands for is student of Islam. And we help create a lot of the Taliban through our textbooks that we provided to incite them to oppose the Soviets. But the Taliban has been successful in large part of maintaining its hold by going into the villages and bringing some order and bringing simple things like water to the population. So they become embraced by the population.
Let's talk a little bit more about that. When we leave Afghanistan, the warring generals that we have funded start killing each other and bombing all the cities trying to gain power. This goes on and on. And young Islamic students take up arms. That's how the Taliban gets going. Taliban is brutal. It's narrow-minded. Everything else you see about it. But it rises from a actual political process in Afghanistan where the people that we install are basically propped us by us. We'll see how they do. But Gary, the newest information is that the Taliban is gaining popularity for just what Gary is talking about. The Afghanistani government is so corrupt, you have to bribe so many people to get a judgment over, over whose land something is, that people are going to the Taliban.
The Taliban
can
set up a government. ISIL can. According to the intelligence sources in the United States and Foreign Policy magazine, what will defeat ISIS, and this is why Obama doesn't want to take them as seriously, is because they can't. They don't have the ability to form a government. They don't have the ability to deliver the goods and services. They are terrible. They have done all the things that we've talked about this morning. But the bottom line is they're not the threat because they're not going to form a state like the Taliban has the ability to do, because they've proven their ability in earlier times that they can deliver on goods and services and set up things that are at once more brutal, at once more efficient than the governments that we have set up.
So let me ask both of you. We have had decades of policies, interventions, meddling, for economic, political reasons, power reasons around the world. What can we do to limit blowback? Mike, Gary, what can we do?
I pulled up my list
to keep making, to stop making mistakes that just cause us more problems in the long run.
I have 15 Mike? Things on my list of things to do.
Okay.
Number one is to not take ISIS. Obama's policy is surgical. He said, this is a precise problem which needs a precise solution. People like Assad throwing barrel bombs out of, you know, airplanes, because they blow up, you know, he won't use them within miles of his own troops because they're horrible. But they cause a lot of blowback. This kind of fighting causes a terrible blowback. So one of the things we don't want to do is do some kind of, as far as I'm concerned, cause more collateral damage and more blowback.
Criticism from the neoconservatives. Let me get specific. Just that, Mike. Is
pulling
that
out the bases, getting the stopping the sanctions, or at least easing the sanctions that are, you know, we have a nuclear problem. We have a discussion we want to have with a country, with Iran, then let's have that discussion. Let's set up those systems that we can. The other thing, I hate to say this, is Iran is a student. She's looking around and saying, gee, the nuclear powers don't get messed with. You've heard me say this on the show before. Pakistan, India, those people that you don't have to use it. You know, Israel is beating the drum that a nuclear-powered, nuclear-armed Iran will be the end of Israel.
Not to oversimplify it, but I think the way you solve this is to look at the issues and policies and stop with all the jingoism and the propaganda. The right wants to keep demanding that Obama use the term Islamic terrorism. Well, it's terrorism.
To attach it to a religion.
I would point everyone to a wonderful article in the January 9th Time magazine. It was a column written by Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. And it was, to me, a brilliant synopsis of the situation, saying that terrorism is not religion. It's politics, pure and simple. We want to simplify it and say that it's all of Islam that is attacking the Christian-based, you know, U.S.
That's because they're told that. They're told that there are principles in Islam that call for this kind of.
But as we've talked about this morning, it's issues and policies that have created blowback. And so if we have a real discussion about the issues and policies of the U.S., we might actually make some headway in ending terrorism.
Would reducing any of these military bases and anything that's aggravating them, would that help? Just cut some of the aggravation down, some of the meddling in everybody's affairs?
I think stopping stealing resources from other countries and people by our corporation and then going in and militarily enforcing their will would be a first start. You know, that'd be a great first step.
And so what else can we do? And in other words, we're jumping into these countries, we're intervening, we're creating enemies through our very aggressive policy.
Well, to catch up with history, according to the professor, globalization should stress our interconnectedness, our commonality, rather than be ways to merely exploit a new population. You know, here's a new company, a new country. Here's new resources we can exploit. We want to be able to establish a code of behavior that the U.S. actually follows in its alphabet organizations, Homeland Security, CIA. We used to have one. We used to say these are places Americans won't go. Torture used to be one of them. Well, there is no code of behavior anymore. There is no single overriding moral guide here for any alphabet organization.
One of the points to make is that a lot of the blowback is from visible policies, like we've been discussing. A lot of the blowback is from secret operations that the United States has carried out, or its allies have carried out, that we may not know about. Next week, we're going to be talking to Michael Austin. And you see, this discussion...
We
had a discussion of torture. We've had two programs about terrorism. The world is it's very, very hard to watch the world, all the wars, all the suffering, the starvation and stuff. So we'll be talking to Michael Austin, who written a book on Job, the ancient text and poem from the Bible. And we're trying to see if that has any illumination on our thing. So
I was just tired of it. You didn't drop the other shoe.
Well, that's right. The problem is...
We don't care anymore. We see starving children. Okay, great.
Isn't that the problem, though, Mike?
Isn't it time for the Super Bowl?
Yeah. No, Mike, the problem is that people are turning off because of the overwhelming violence and depressed
state. That's what
we
want to talk about.
And we want to talk about how do you stay involved and keep
guys.
Focusing
see you
next week. Been listening to Democratic Perspective, brought to you by the Verde Valley Independent Democrats, a weekly talk show focusing on the political issues facing the Verde Valley, Sedona, Northern Arizona, and the nation at large. Catch us every Monday morning after the 8 o'clock news, right here on AM 780 KAZM. It's beautiful out there, folks.